The National Guild of Hypnotists would like to welcome you to this session, which was recorded live at the NGH Convention and Educational Conference held August 12th through 14th, 2011 in Marlborough, Massachusetts. This recording is designed to provide the actual presentation and is distributed with the understanding that the opinions of the speakers are not necessarily those of NGH. This recording is copyright 2011, National Guild of Hypnotists. We take you now to Marlborough, Massachusetts, where the session is about to begin.
Okay, well, thank you, Francois, for putting this up on the board. You all have the number, the name. My name is Julie Gerland, those of you who don't know. And our website, holisticparentingprogram.com.
Holistic Parenting Program.
That's what I said, holisticparentingprogram.com. And for those of you who didn't get it, holisticparentingprogram.com. Great. Well, I'm really delighted once again to be back here to share with you something which is a lifelong passion for me. And I hope to give you a little taste of the importance of this subject, because we are all affected, absolutely all of us. How many of you are worried about the world situation right now? Not worried?
I'm not worried.
Not worried, okay.
Oh, not worried.
Concerned?
I wouldn't use the word worried.
Not worried, okay.
Attention to it.
Yeah.
We are worried or not worried?
We haven't.
How many of you are, I said?
I'm worried.
Or concerned?
Yeah.
Worried?
Aware.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm worried.
Worried? Yeah.
Not about the economy. No.
Okay.
I'm not worried about the economy. No, I'm worried about the next generation of children.
Absolutely. Concerned. Yeah. Because what's happening is affecting us all now. The world has become a global village.
Yeah.
And 30 years ago, I was young, idealistic. I'm still young and idealistic. But I was really asking myself, how can we live on this planet healthily, happily, in abundance, and to have a human family worldwide? I even went to the United Nations in New York and worked for an NGO called Planetary Citizens, where we gave out planetary passports. I was absolutely convinced, as I am today, that it's possible. But I didn't know how to start, how to get going to really make a difference. So I went into all kinds of different things, from setting up a children's center in the slums in Hong Kong, where I'm from, to going to the United Nations and thinking, well, it's starting at the top, to working through different types of education, health. And every time I went down an avenue, I came to a chicken and egg situation and said, well, wait a minute, this is just not going to work. Until in 1982, so that's what, nearly 30 years ago, I came across a book from a spiritual teacher called Education Begins Before Birth. And when I read this book, this little book, in the middle of it, it said, if we were to look after pregnant women, within two generations, that's just 50 years, we could close our prisons and close our hospitals. I just cried. And I said, that's it. That is what I must do. Mm-hmm. So, a few months later, fortunately, thanks to a Canadian psychiatrist, Dr. Thomas Verney, he brought out the science, the beginning of the science 30 years ago, with a groundbreaking book called The Secret Life of the Unborn Child. Mm-hmm. And this is still a classic, although he started a whole movement to studying the impact of what the mother lives during pregnancy and how that affects the growing, developing baby in utero and the long-term consequences. These two books together, I said, that's it. Now I can go out and change the world and we can close our prisons and close our hospitals. Well, look where we are today. We're not there yet, are we? We've gone down a very, very slippery slope. The thing is that we know. We now have 30 years of science between early 80s and now as to what the mother lives and the impact of that. In Time magazine at the end of last year, I think it was September, October, Time magazine ran a book review. Full front page of Time magazine was a pregnant woman, beautiful image, of a book that had come out called Origins. How the first 9 months of your life affect the rest of your life. I really recommend reading it. Because now there is absolutely no excuse. We have now files and files and data banks bursting with information. What we need to do is to apply this. I now represent a non-governmental organization at the United Nations with a special consultative status with the Economic and Social Council of the UN to bring this information to government level. I'm going to tell you a little bit about what we know, the impact, and how we as hypnotists can be most effective with this knowledge to bring about the types of society that I'm sure all of us would love to live in and certainly love to bring about for the next generations, so that you can feel empowered to know it is possible. We just need to do it. That's all. And now working with the government level, it is about political will. It's not about knowing what to do. Make no mistake about that. It's absolutely clear. Okay? So what do we know? We now know that by the time a baby is born, newborn baby is born, that baby has already lived 9 months of constant hypnosis. 9 months of constant hypnosis. I'm going to tell you a little story. About 15 years ago, my brother invited me to visit him in the UK. And he had two young children and said, "Oh, I hope you don't mind. Tomorrow we're going to go to a birthday party with the kids." I said, "Fantastic, great." We went to this party. There must have been about 10, 12 kids all playing together. And we, the adults, sat together and just talked amongst ourselves. And I just noticed, as we all did, the behavior of these children. All of them played happily and normally, except one. One little boy whose behavior was noticeably totally different from the others. And at one time, he actually tried to swing like Tarzan on the drapes. plus other things. And so at the end of the day, we said goodbye to everybody, get in the car, we start driving down the highway, and my brother looks across to me, and he's driving, and he said, "You know, did you have a nice day?" So I said, "Yeah, it was really nice, thank you." So he said, "I wonder if you noticed anything different about little Johnny." So knowing me a little bit and my experience with this period of life, I said to him, "Yeah." And he said, "What?" And I said, "Do you really want to know?" I'm careful now. When I give out information, there's nothing more powerful than the truth. And so he swallowed and said, "Yeah, I really want to know." So I said, "Well, it's very clear. This little boy was conceived by drunken parents." "Oh, you slammed on the brakes." Almost provoked an accident. Almost stopped. And he's looking at me like that. Now, he knows that I'm very sensitive and that, you know, I can tune in a lot to who people are and what they've lived. But this was a real shock to him. He went on and confirmed that he knows the parents very well. They're next door neighbors. They share the same twin houses, semi-detached houses, we call them in England. And he said, it's amazing. He said, when this couple, our best friends, conceived their child, they didn't want another child. They already had one. They had gone to a Christmas party. They came home in British English, absolutely blottoed, which translated in American would be
drunk as a skunk.
Drunk as a skunk, right? Thank you for the translation. And went ahead and conceived this child. And of course, when they found out that she was pregnant, they were horrified. They didn't want this child. They had concealed this information from everybody but my brother. And he said, how did you know? So I said, well, it's not often that people actually confirm it to me like that. I just feel. I said, this was written all over him. All over him. So we know that the state of consciousness during conception has a huge impact. There was a an American child psychiatrist many years ago who wrote a book. She was given the care of young children under the age of 10 who had committed very violent crimes. And this is here in this country, upstate New York. And the state didn't know what to do with these children. And so she said, look, I'll take them on. And she used to get down on her hands and knees and just play with these children. Play, if you see what I mean. pace them, be with them, use the same bad language as them. Just allow them to say anything so they felt safe with her. And twice, within a very short period, she said, she heard one boy say, well, in any case, I just didn't like the energy around my conception. And she's a child psychiatrist. And so she went even closer to this young boy and said, oh yeah? Well, what was it like? And he proceeded to tell her in detail what he lived during that conception. So she then started a lot of research, a lot of work into, she wrote a book called The Psalms of Children. Psalms, P-S-A-L-M-S. Their children's stories, many of these children had never known one night of peaceful sleep in a secure home, and how this had impacted them from conception. So we have many, many, many stories of conception, of pregnancy. Just a little story about pregnancy in my own family. My brother was born with this passionate desire to save snakes. He used to walk down to the local market in Hong Kong, where we grew up, Chinese market, and with his pocket money, he would buy up the snakes in the cage that were due to be made into soup or eaten for the bile or whatever. He used to buy them up, bring them home, keep them in the basement, didn't tell my parents that he had them, and he was and he had to tell them one Christmas where he said, the snake has just got to come upstairs in front of the fire. Yes, it does get cold in Hong Kong. And so then he had to tell my mother that he had these snakes, that he absolutely loved them, and we just absolutely had to keep them. And this was a mystery for a long time, because my brother at the age of 14 went on to become an Asian snake specialist. He toilet trained a 6-foot python.
Oh my goodness.
And had people come in from all over to see how he was with these snakes. But where did he get this passion from? We couldn't understand it. My parents would you know, not into this kind of thing at all. In Hong Kong, you know, the Chinese people have this huge fear of snakes, and of course they eat them. But why would he want to save them? And it wasn't until I was going into this subject to discover and see the correlation between what the mother lives during pregnancy and then later on in life, how the child develops, the child's interest, the child's nature, the child's character. It's not 100%, because it's obviously a little bit more complicated than that, but largely influenced by what the mother lives. And what happened to my mother when we started to say, but, you know, what on earth did you live to have a son that was passionate about saving snakes? And she went back into her memory and she said, well, the only thing I can think of was she lived in Singapore and when she was pregnant with my brother. And when one afternoon she went to have a rest, she went into her bedroom, and just as she did, she saw the tail end of a snake that had untwined itself from near the bed and started to escape over the window out into their tropical yard. And she took fright, there was a snake, and screamed, and obviously was frightened. She was, you know, very pregnant, and called my father, who was a soldier. So he arrived, swung through the jungle, found the snake, killed the snake, basically in front of her, held it up, and suddenly she was thinking, oh my God, you know, I could have got into bed with the snake. I mean, they took it to the local museum to get it analyzed and were told that it was just a harmless grass snake. And she was taken with huge remorse. Why did this poor little grass snake, who hadn't done anything wrong to anybody, get killed just because of her fear? So there was this remorse of having wanting, in fact, to have saved that snake's life. That my brother's born with this passion to save all these snakes. So this is just one story. We know that many famous musicians, when asked where did they get their love for music, it was because their mother was playing. Yehudi Menuhin said this publicly in an interview many years ago before his death, that he got his love of music when his mother was playing while she was pregnant. So we know that what the mother lives, not only her activities, but how she feels deep down inside herself, her subconscious feelings are translated and passed on to the child. We know that the birth experience, it's not just, well, the baby's healthy, yanked out, you know, is breathing properly and it's got all its arms and legs and head in place. We know that that baby is living its own experience of what does it really feel like to come out into this world. Is somebody there for them? We know that when a baby is placed or even crawls, a newborn baby can crawl from the tummy, it's just left, up to the breast, that that moment of contact eye to eye at 12 inches, which just happens to be from the point of nursing to the mother's eye. The studies now have been done to show what happens when that first glance between a newborn baby and the mother is a cocktail of hormones that will never be repeated again. And this tells the child, and it turns on the systems in this body, the baby's body, that says, I exist as a separate being. I am loved. Somebody's there for me. I'm connected. That's what in the body, in the biochemistry of the baby, that is what gets switched on. Now, if you take what's happening in our society, what are some of the, your hypnotherapists, what are the people who come into our offices, what are they suffering from? Disconnectedness? Mm-hmm. Big one? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Where is that coming from? No, it doesn't just happen. We know this from the moment of conception, through pregnancy, through the birth. Are we actually there for that child? Is that child wanted? Is that child conceived in love? Does the both parents talk to that baby, interact with that baby, play with that baby through pregnancy? We know this has an impact, huge impact. And then the natural birth, are the parents that are available to receive that baby? Are they emotionally available to be with the baby? Now, I give conferences all over the world, and recently I was in one on the World Congress for Maternal and Infant Health. And I gave a presentation about how the mother's thoughts and feelings translate into her biochemistry. And that this, if we are now to talk about maternal and infant health, which is high on the agenda of the UN, we must talk mother's feelings. How does she feel? Because this is what is being translated into the health and emotional structure of whether the baby feels safe. And what happens if you have a baby that comes into the world that doesn't feel safe? It's a huge difference. We know that as hypnotherapists. It's a huge difference from being safe and from a doctor saying, well, I know you're safe because we're doctors and nothing can happen to you, or feeling safe. Right? So it's how the mother feels that counts. And so I get up there and tell doctors, take into consideration the mother's feelings, because that is what is being translated into the baby's health and well-being. And when I presented this information at this World Congress on Infant and Maternal and Infant Health, I had two replies. One doctor, wearing a grey suit, very pale complexion, as if he'd never seen the sun in his life, wrinkled, took the microphone, looked right down, and said in a monotonous voice, governments should pass more laws to force women to do what we want them to do. And handed on the microphone. And people have said to me since, what did you say? And I said, what can you say?
Yeah.
He said it all for himself. He spoke for himself. But what I know is he didn't speak for himself. There are thousands, hundreds of thousands of doctors that he represented when he said that. Mm-hmm. And then there was another voice. Another man stood up, wearing beige slacks, a pink shirt, sort of a guy you'd see around NGH conference. And he stood up, he took the microphone, he looked at everybody, and he said, I feel so ashamed, so guilty. He said, because what you've just said, we obstetricians, we gynecologists, we know that. And he said, we absolutely do not take it into consideration. And he said, my country, the Venezuela, he said, is on the brink of absolute chaos. And he said, we know that it's because of what you just said. And he said, we don't do anything about it. He said, I'm now going to go home and practice medicine in a totally different way. So we know, we can do it. Mothers are the ones to look after. Dads as well. But if we want to do something to help the state of the world, every human being is designed by nature to come through parents. So I talk about school womb, your first school womb, play on words with the room, is the womb. So if we really do look after pregnant women, and of course it has to start from before conception, parents have got, both parents have got to know the importance of preparation before conception. We actually know now that a mother is downloading the DNA, the genes that she will pass on to her child 2 months before she's pregnant. So you know that in the ovaries there's a stock of eggs. So there's one which is now in somebody who's menstruating is leaving the body. Well, the one before that is starting to get ready, and it's downloading the genes that when that egg is ready, and if it's fertilized, will have that DNA in place. So why isn't it all just done before? Why isn't it all just pre-recorded from generation to generation? It's not. Nature is very, very intelligent, in case you haven't noticed, far more intelligent than us when we detach from that intelligence. So what happens is that a mother is living her experience, and now I'm talking subjective experience and objective experience. So we'll talk about the objective experience being the environment. Okay? So if the mother is living through a war, for example, her environment is not in peace. Okay? So automatically, we don't think about it, subconsciously and even unconsciously, she's preparing, okay, well, if I was to get pregnant now and we're in a war situation, I have got to prepare my child to survive in that kind of environment. Okay? And all mammals do this. So these are the genes that she will subconsciously or unconsciously select, the ones that are going to give her child the strength to live in this environment of war. Now the thing is that the subjective is also true and very powerful. As we know as hypnotists, it's the subjective that we have left behind in our materialistic world. So what if the mother is living in a peaceful environment, but inside she is at war with herself, fighting maybe her own body image, fighting, what else could she be fighting? Sabotaging herself, having a fight with a spouse. She could have just lost somebody dear to her and be upset with God. Why do you let people die? I mean, all sorts of things that we live. Well, this is also, she will be downloading the genes that will provide the child the optimum conditions genetically to survive that kind of environment. So the implications are huge. If we want a peaceful society, what must we do? We have, absolutely, be at peace. We have to help future parents, and this is what we do, my husband and I. We have a parenting program that helps future parents, couples, to prepare for conception, pregnancy, and birth so that they can change their own view of the world and of themselves before conceiving. Because what we know is that by the time the child has had gone through the genetic selection, which is passed on at conception, the conception, the 9 months or thereabouts of gestation, plus the birth experience, that during this time, the baby in hypnosis, this whole time, is just downloading its experience, arrives in the world having already put in hardwired into itself whether they are coming into a friendly or a hostile environment. They are the two choices. Hang on just one sec. If you can just bear with me, we'll have some questions at the end. And it's interesting enough that Albert Einstein, when he was asked, what is the most important question for mankind to answer right now? And he said, is the world a friendly or a hostile place? The universe. Friendly or hostile? In fact, I think he precisely said, is the universe a hostile place? Which implies it could be friendly. We know that this is not something that one day scientists are going to declare that they have discovered. We know that it is subjective. And that's what I love about talking of the NGH. You don't need to have to explain all that. You know what I mean. So from a subjective point of view, this baby is already coming into the world hardwired. This is a hostile place. What is that baby's physiology going to be prepared for?
Fight.
Fight. Protection. Yeah. Freeze.
Yeah.
And then what do we see? 5-year-olds going to school. And we can see them coming into a class. Ask Tina. She knows all about it. We can see them arriving in school. And they're either open to growth, to love, or closed. And physiologically, these two sets of hormones that are the most powerful in our body, the adrenaline and cortisol response, stress hormones, fight and flight, or freeze. And the other one, love. Physiologically, these two are antagonistic. You can't have them both at the same time in your body. So if you've been hardwired, because your mother has lived in constant stress, ask my husband all about this. I mean, at 8 months, he was saying to himself as a baby, I'm out of here. This is so stressful. Get me out. You know? And we know through, of course, and many of you will have done regressions in hypnosis and had people go back to the pre-birth experience. So you know what I'm talking about. But the consequences individually are huge. The consequences in our society, the consequences for our world are massive. So if we want peaceful, loving, open, connected people, what must we do? Yes! You haven't fallen asleep. Take care of the mothers. So, recently, United Nations Secretary General Ban Ki-moon, lovely man, he decided that women were important. Imagine that. And he said, we need to create a commission on women. Yes. And he put the ex-president of Chile, Madame Bachelet, as the president of this commission. So I said, wow, what a good idea after all this time. And I went on their site as a UN representative for an NGO. And I looked at all they're doing for women. I thought, well, that's good, that's good, that's good, that's good. Nothing for mothers. Nothing. Nothing. Women, mothers are the mother of humanity. The mothers of humanity. They're the ones that will save the world. But we have to wake them up. We have to realize. They have to realize. Have you ever talked to a woman and met her at a party or something and said, oh, well, what do? And she says, oh, nothing. And not even that. So I said, oh, do you have children? Oh, yeah, I have 4. I said, and you do nothing? So she said, well, you know what I mean. And I said, no, you don't know what I mean. Look at all the things you do. This is fantastic what you do. So just one other little anecdote. it's a big story. At a New Year's Eve party recently in the south of France where we live, we were invited to a chateau. And so we arrived and there were some guests already there with champagne, walked in, and we got introduced, and this man said to me, "Oh, well, you know, what do you do?" So I don't miss many occasions to get on my little hobby horse. And so I jumped on my hobby horse and started galloping away. And then I said, "Oh," I said, "I'm really sorry." I said, "I kind of got a bit carried away there." I said, "You know, especially for a New Year's Eve party." And he said, "No," he said, "that's really interesting. Carry on." So I said, "Okay then." I carried on galloping. And then I said, "Okay, now your turn. I'm going to stop. What do you do?" And he said, "Prenatal." I said, "No." He said, "Yeah." He said, "I'm a psychiatrist." And he said, "I was given a task by the British government to find out why we have murderers and high-level sex offenders." He said, "So I did a study, went into the prisons." And he said, "After conducting my study," he said, "I put in a report to the British government." So I said, "And?" So he said, "Well," he said, "you know." So I said, "Yeah, I know." I said, "But I want to know what you know." So he said, "The conclusion is absolutely conclusive." He said, "If we don't want to have murderers and we don't want high-level sex offenders, we must give every single parent, mother and father, 2 years full paid maternity leave from conception to the first year after birth. And they have to attend parenting classes. They can't just go to the beach." Mm-hmm. You know? He said, "Then we wouldn't have these problems." Yeah, wow. And what's worse is that he then took a room at Oxford University to present his findings to the appropriate government officials. He sent out invitations to everybody. And he said he got all the replies, people were coming. And as the time got closer and closer, people started to call up and say they couldn't come. And by the end, the night before his presentation, one man was coming. And so he said to himself, "Well, too bad. I've got the room and the presentation. I'm just going to do it for one person." And he said, the very morning, that one person called up and said, "I'm really sorry, but I just can't make it." And so he said, "Look, okay, but can you tell me why? Please tell me why." And so he said, "My secretary doesn't want me to." Secretary, woman, secretary. So he said, "Julie, nobody came. So that whole report has been filed in some drawer somewhere. Nobody wants to know." So in this field, we often call it the other inconvenient truth. You heard about the first one. This stuff is not convenient, for sure. But that doesn't make it true. So the implications are huge. You know, if you were to work with pregnant women, what does every single human being need? It's not rocket science. If I worked it out, doctors can work it out. What do we need? We need to feel unconditionally loved, respected. Safe, respected, mm-hmm. cared for, listened to, validated, nourished, don't we?
But every man needs every human being.
Absolutely. So if we start by giving these things to women, if we just start. And those women are going to be respected, loved as the mother of humanity. Validated. Innately, she has the custody of the health of every of one of her children, of the village. It's in her. It's ingrained. Nature has given her that task to absolutely, unconditionally love her children, to want the best for them, to look after them, to know if they're sick, to know what they need. They do this. Animals even do it. You know, there's more respect in the gorilla world for mummy gorilla than there is in our hospitals. So it's massive, really, really massive. It's the subjective, it's what women feel that will translate into her biology, which will affect the next generations. Very easy. So I could go on, there's so much more to say, because as you can see, this is something which is so passionate, and the consequences are so huge, because we've all lived it for ourselves. We can stop it, and we can decide collectively as a human family now to put the mothers in the center of that family and to empower her to get back that instinct that she has to birth her children in safety, in the place that she chooses to have her baby, because she feels well, she feels supported, and that she feels listened to. She is listened to. Often I have to say, you know, mothers are not stupid. Stop treating them as stupid. They know. And I have to say this to couples. It's amazing. They don't get it. Mothers are probably the most intelligent with their babies. We know a brand new baby has more neurons than the baby's pediatrician. Brand new babies are fully aware, fully speaking. We're now having, there's lots of research being done to understand their language, to understand their first cry. It's amazing what's coming out. On this primal period, we say, from preconception to the first year after birth, it is the study of the future. There is no doubt in my mind. The implications are colossal. So as I said, we've got very few minutes left. There's a few hands that have gone up for questions. Come to you in a second.
I'd love to know if you're aware of any research on medical interventions for challenging births that come up and how that shapes the child's personality.
So the question is on the research on medical interventions. There are data banks full of this information. Of course, there's also the variables because of the subjective. Mm-hmm. So
like how the mom is feeling, yes. When?
Yes.
Okay.
This is absolutely clear that what we know now, and this is not specific, but this is over many research studies that have been done, it's that you can have the same intervention and you can have one woman who inside feels that they're doing it for the best, mm-hmm. These people are really here to help me, and she feels that is what is going to have the impact. She feels connected with her mother, with the baby. That is what is going to prime over all the rest. If for some reason or other a woman is in fear and shock and she loses it because there's nobody around to help her, then that, whatever the intervention is going to be, that is what is going to prime.
And what do you do for a child who had that experience, they're young? How do you help them heal from that? You know that there's a limbic imprint there. So
definitely.
What do you do?
So how do we help babies and children to heal from this? There are many modalities. There are some chiropractors who work with newborns, and I've actually witnessed quite a lot of these healings, which are absolutely fantastic, because babies will naturally actually relive their birth process if they're given the possibility to do so in a safe way. Babies and children are in hypnosis, mm-hmm. So using all our hypnotic language and understanding, I've worked with mothers who have regretted, even when the child is grown up, 15, 16-year-olds, regretted what had happened during the birth. And I've suggested that she you know, goes into that pain that she's carrying because it's shared. It has to be shared. You know, if a child has been hurt, the mother is too. And so if she can go into that pain and then voice out and say, you know, I never wanted to hurt you. You know what it's like if you're in a couple and or with somebody in a close relationship and they accidentally hurt you. And if they just don't say anything, how you feel. But if they turn around to you, no matter how bad the wound is, and say, take you by the hand or call you up and say, you know, I guess that must have hurt, but you know what? I never really wanted to hurt you. I didn't mean to hurt you. I'm really sorry. It doesn't necessarily take away the hurt, but it makes it a lot easier. So the first thing is really to say, I'm sorry. Acknowledge babies from the moment of conception. We know they are aware. We know they're having their own experience. Validate that experience. And speak. And then, of course, you have all the hypnotic language that we have and all the protocols and the techniques we have of healing, which are very valid. Mm-hmm. So there was another question at the back?
Yes. Julia, thank you for this, because I've looked forward to this talk, of all the talks. I really did. I thought this was the most important one, and I almost missed it. I had to, when I was reading through everything, I went, this is something that's important. I'm a perinatal clinical nurse specialist, and I work now in hypnosis. And part of what I'm developing in my practice are very much in line with the things you're doing. And, you know, I just wanted to tell you that I understand and I agree with you. That it comes up frequently in my client work that mm. clients have experiences in utero that mm. are instrumental to the issues they're challenged with, as you know, all through their life or later.
Absolutely.
That they present in the office.
Yeah. Absolutely.
The second thing is, could you give us the name of the gentleman who wrote the report that didn't get attention paid? The UK gentleman. You know his last name?
I think that would be a little bit. Delicate, but it's not a no.
Oh, okay,
well, no, unfortunately. I think it would be a bit difficult because it hasn't even been acknowledged by the British government. I would like to get a copy of the report.
Yeah,
I've asked
yeah.
him three times and he hasn't even replied to my email, so I'm sorry about that.
Yeah, that's all right.
Another question?
Yes. In regards to adoption, you adopted two children, and of course, you don't know really what went on during the pregnancy and before. And some of them have beautiful experiences and others don't. But by switching, because the child set up for what he came in to have, and then switches to hopefully a loving home. When you're saying you can repair things, my son's 39 and I still feel that there's an issue for the disconnect.
So the question really is about adoption. It's a big one. And how can we repair that early traumatism, because it is a traumatism, an abandonment, which of course, is, I hope you've just all understood, yeah. It goes very, very deep inside our psyche. You know, what kind of conception, what kind of circumstances that baby was carried. So the child is now 39, an adult. And a wonderful father to his children.
Well, that's because of the good work you did.
Of course, the environment,
the
environment, the loving environment that you have offered him, will have an epigenetic effect.
Yes.
So that is the effect of the environment on the genes, and will have brought out the genes, activated the genes given from his lineage. But there probably still is, I wouldn't have any doubt about it, a deep sense of abandonment and possibly mistrust and probably just not feeling good enough. Why, if I'm intact, why would a mother leave me?
Yeah.
And it's not in the brain, as we know. He probably understands as a 39-year-old how that happened and why and whatever. But deep inside, the pain is there. How can that happen to me? So he would have to decide to go through a hypnosis session and go back to whatever happened at that time and do the necessary process work for that healing to take place.
Is it?
Another question?
I was just going to ask, is it possible for him to find the mother at this point?
His whole life, he said he's never really had a desire.
We have really just to finish off. Can we, just one more question? Did you have a question?
I was going
to
ask if that would be the same or a bit different if the mother passed away. And my mom was born in the morning, and her mom had a heart attack and passed away in the afternoon, so she really, I mean, I'm aware of, as her child, how much that impacted our lives.
Completely. So, we can repair. That's what's fantastic about hypnosis. And, without hypnosis, how could we do this? We can't intellectualize all this stuff. You have to go back to where that happened inside yourself, in the subconscious, or even in the unconscious, and do that work at that stage. But of course it has an impact. Everything has an impact.
Julie, do you think that age regression, because supposedly we're supposed to go back generations or other lives, do you think that? I'm a newbie on this, but do you think age regression would help a situation like this?
Do you mean to go back to the time of birth or pre-birth?
Other lives?
Definitely. In the work that we do, we work with people to take them back to the original moment of pain or separation or whatever their issue is, the cause. And then when they've dealt with things in this life, we will very often, if somebody wants to say, well, how come I came in with this experience, I would now like to go back and see what happened and fix it at a higher level, either a preconception contract, the contract that the soul has made before they came into the world, or what happened in a past life. And of course that has a great impact in the quality of life now, which is what we want. Thank you all very much for coming. Thank you.